The Civic Flame, a podcast where we take a deep dive into the U.S. Constitution and how it does, and doesn't, shape what's going on in politics today. As usual, I am Dr. Amber. I am a law and policy professor at Worcester State University, and I am here to walk you through this absolutely crazy journey. Now, you may have noticed, if you've been a longer time listener, that we took a bit of a hiatus last week, but hey, if it's good enough for Congress, it's good enough for me. But unlike the House of Representatives, that has not been working during what is now officially the longest government shutdown in U.S. history, I took the Senate's approach and still kept plugging away at stuff. We changed our podcast hosting to Audio Boom, so bear with me as I check out our new features and see what's up. As we continue on with our podcast episodes, we're looking today at the end, finally, of Article 1 and the powers of the legislative branch. If you're only going to listen to one episode on the legislative branch, you'll want to check out our last one on enumerated powers, spelling out exactly what Congress can and maybe can't do. Today, we're looking at the limits that the Constitution theoretically puts on Congress and what that means for big issues like interstate commerce, making new states, and even, gasp, secession. So grab a seat by the fire and let's go. Well, last week we covered the fundamental section of Congress's powers, the enumerated powers, or Article 1, Section 8, where Congress gets some really great powers like making a post office, declaring war, and levying taxes. It also has the very important Necessary and Proper Clause, which gives Congress what are called implied or unstated powers. These relate to some extent to the enumerated powers because Congress has all the power to carry into law what it needs to ensure that these powers, or the enumerated powers, are effective. As if that weren't difficult enough to figure out what exactly that all means and where exactly the lines are drawn between necessary and proper implied powers and ridiculously broad federal overreach, we also have Article 1, Section 9, which limits what Congress can do. As I tell my students, there's a multiple different levels of law that kind of operate at the same time. There's what we know is forbidden. There's what we know is required. But somewhere in between there is a lot of stuff that may or may not be allowed. And what you'll see a lot of people, particularly institutions, people representing institutions, people representing interest groups or organizations, trying to do is really push the bounds of what is allowed and say, you should or shouldn't be allowed to do this. You should or shouldn't be forbidden. You should or shouldn't be required. And that's where we get a lot of law. One of the reasons this is difficult is because in order to be effective, law needs to be flexible enough to change with the times. But when you have something like a constitution, you need that to be more stable over time because it's this big governing document that kind of sets out the social contract for the country. So it gets a little complicated. Hashtag it's difficult. Article 1, Section 9 increases this difficulty in some ways and decreases it in others because it talks about the powers denied to Congress. And it actually starts with an obsolete section that says Congress can't limit the international slave trade until 1808, at which point most enslaved people were born here and human trafficked away from their parents. So there was no reason to regulate the international slave trade. It was a clever way to help the enslavers, who were a fundamental part of drafting the Constitution, manage to simultaneously outline a document meant to provide freedom while also enshrining the absolute unfreedom of a whole lot of people. Not for nothing, but the Massachusetts Constitution, which I believe is the oldest written operating constitution in the world and does predate the U.S. Constitution, wrote that all men were free. And this was actually used by enslaved folks here in Massachusetts to legally abolish slavery in the Commonwealth under those laws. So we do know that enslavement could be abolished without needing to go through the Civil War, because it had happened in several other states. But moving from the obsolete section, we get into some pretty serious stuff. We start with, and I quote, "The privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion of the public safety may require it," end quote. It's pretty important. The writ of habeas corpus is basically your ability to get due process. Habeas corpus roughly translates to body of law, or you have the body as a more literal translation, but the body in question is the body of laws. Basically, if we're not studying Latin, and we're not, habeas corpus is your right to sue or to demand due process and to see that you are being lawfully treated. You're being lawfully searched, you're being lawfully seized, you're being lawfully detained. You can avail yourself of all of those rights of the accused. But note here that there are some really scary exceptions to this. Rebellion and threats to the public safety. Those can be pretty broad. When the Constitution is written, we don't really have a standing army. And really until World War II, it was not common at all to have a regular standing army that was just always there. So saying in cases of rebellion or public safety really was different at a time before you could mobilize a lot of troops to go in and deal with a rebellion or go in and deal with public safety. The next section deals with a lot of similar stuff. No bill of attainder or ex post facto law shall be passed. A bill of attainder, which is very hard to say with a Massachusetts accent because there are just too many vowels and R's next to each other. It is a bill that says a certain person or group can be detained or charged without trial. And an ex post facto law means that you're making something illegal after somebody did it and trying to punish them for the fact. So, like saying that red cars are illegal tomorrow, but that anyone who bought one in the last year is also in trouble. Remember that many of these protections came from things that the colonists had experienced or were credibly concerned that they would experience under the English monarchy. So suspending the writ of habeas corpus or saying there's a war so you don't have any rights was pretty classic. If you look at these things together, you can see how they might work under different types of corrupt or authoritarian regimes. In places that have been under these kinds of regimes, like the Democratic Republic in East Germany, the GDR, when it was totally controlled by the Soviet Union, it was not uncommon for laws to be completely suspended due to, quote, public safety, or for individual groups to be targeted without trial, all of that bill of attainder stuff, or ex post facto laws, like saying a member in a certain group was illegal now and always, even though they technically weren't. Meaning that even if you'd been a member of a group a few years ago and you left that group because you didn't like it or you realized there was something wrong or you just grew out of it, you could still be in trouble today for doing it. This has recently been a problem with social media because people who live in authoritarian regimes but also have access to things like Facebook, they put things online and they've sort of started to realize that some of their very old posts that may have been legal at the time can really come back and bite them today when those ideas are now dangerous or subversive or those groups are now illegal. For more on this, check out our 3-part campfire episode on how social media might be destroying the world. Things like this are also likely why places like Germany were very reluctant to accept social media. And Germany was one of the countries that had the most limitations on citizen data collection. German citizens learned from living under fascism that any organization that takes too much of your private information really can become a problem. So in this digital age, all of this archaic sounding stuff like ex post facto laws and bill of attainder are actually quite relevant. And I'm going to go get myself a sticker because I think I pronounced the R in attainder every time I said it, which is very exciting for me. But there's some more stuff out there in this section of the Constitution on things like taxes, the limitations on using taxes to target any one state. This is a question we're having now with the president and the executive branch targeting certain states by withholding funding. It creates a very interesting question of, is that the same thing as targeting states by taxing them? Legally, maybe not. Factually, maybe. So what's the law to do? I don't know. Go find a lawyer who gets paid a lot more money than I do. One of the things that was also changed in this section of the Constitution regarding taxes was the income tax. The 16th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution establishes an income tax, and so that changes things a little bit. There's also some general points about how Congress can't play favorites among the states, so that might come into play soon. And so you get sections like, no preference shall be given by any regulation of commerce or revenue to the ports of one state over those of another, nor shall vessels bound to or from one state be obliged to enter, clear, or pay duties in another. A lot of this section, along with Section 8, was about interstate commerce. Part of this was to create an economic union to help drive a social and political one. If we were interconnected in economic necessity, then maybe we'd be better friends. After all, we're supposed to be one family, and nobody's supposed to pick favorites. But that hasn't seemed to work out. And it kind of reminds me of the ridiculous 90s neoliberal Lexus and the Olive Tree kind of maybe early 2000s mentality. Thomas Friedman types, you know, they would comment about how economics would end world wars. Neoliberal capitalism would end world wars because no two nations with a McDonald's had ever gone to war. Reductivist and oversimplified? Yes. But is it useless and harmful rhetoric that just keeps economists thinking that they're anything other than astrologers in suits? Yeah, also yes. Economists are hilarious, though not usually on purpose. And the absolute pearl clutching when Russia invaded Ukraine, particularly people saying things like, but no two nations with a McDonald's had ever invaded each other. It's like, okay, maybe that doesn't work. Maybe we need more than just, you know, rich people making money to secure world peace. I don't know. Call me crazy. But speaking of money, the next paragraph in the Constitution says, no money shall be drawn from the Treasury, but in consequence of appropriations made by law, and a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. This is basically a way of saying, show me the receipts. Literally, you can't be spending the money without going through the process. And when you spend the money, we want to know where it goes. This is obviously an interesting issue with the government shutdown, though I would point out that in many other countries, if the legislature cannot agree on a budget, it doesn't trigger a government shutdown. It triggers an election. You put their job on the line until they can do their job. And it might take a constitutional amendment to make that happen in our culture, but it's certainly one that would be worth a try. But organizations within the federal government, like the Congressional Budget Office and the Government Accountability Office, are similar to internal affairs groups that are meant to keep track of money and policy. Unfortunately, even before the government shutdown, they were some of the first groups to be cut by Elon Musk's legally dubious Doge organization, which is ironic because if you want to save money, these would be the organizations that already had years of data showing you how. But Musk was interested in two things: underfunding agencies that were investigating and fining him, which he did, and getting all of our data for different AI and other models, which he also did when he accessed Social Security. Lastly, with Section 9, we have the no titles of nobility shall be granted by the United States, and no person holding any office of profit or trust under them shall, without the consent of Congress, accept of any present, emolument, office, or title of any kind whatever from any king, prince, or foreign state. We talked a bit about emoluments before. These are basically extra money or benefits that you get. So your regular paycheck or money back for on-the-job travel expenses, not emoluments, and they're perfectly legal. Anything extra, like money or insider trading information or information on tax policies or titles of nobility, those are not legal. It's important to see that the founders knew bad actors would be in government, and they gave us laws to get rid of them. Unfortunately, in order to maintain the smaller government structure and to keep agencies from stealing each other's power, the founders did not make any of these laws self-enforcing. Someone has to bring charges, someone has to prosecute, and basically, someone has to hold someone else accountable. But when you have a lot of people who don't want to risk being held accountable themselves, then they don't want to hold anyone else accountable either. So that basically explains how we got where we are with the government and the lack of responsibility that, if my students are any indication, filters down to all of us with their modeling of bad behavior. Continuing with our thou shalt nots, Article 1, Section 10 talks about what the states can't do. No state shall enter into any treaty, alliance, or confederation, grant letters of reprisal, coin money, emit bills of credit, and so on and so forth. A lot of this talks about basically restating many of the things from Article 1, Section 8. And it kind of says there's a lot of stuff Congress can't do, titles of nobility and so on, that states also can't do. But there's still some stuff the federal government can do, coin money, decide legal tender, that states still can't do. One of the interesting ones that states can't do is enter into treaties, alliances, or confederations. This was basically the reasoning behind saying the South couldn't secede during the Civil War when they committed treason by firing on Fort Sumter in South Carolina. But the interesting question that has come up over and over again is whether or not states can secede or join any of these kinds of union or confederations with the consent of the federal government. That's an unclear question. A few years ago, Marjorie Taylor Greene asked for a national divorce. And so one of the questions is if the states can't unilaterally secede, that means secede without the agreement of the federal government, can they be kicked out? Can the government say, you're done here, we don't want you anymore? Or could a mutual agreement of walking away from each other for irreconcilable civic differences be an issue? I don't know. It's a question that will eventually come up again. But the next section talks a lot more about taxes and tariffs. Basically, it says states can't tax the federal government. This is something you'll hear reiterated in the case called McCulloch v. Maryland in 1819 that has to do with whether or not the federal government can set up a bank and whether or not the state of Maryland could tax them for doing so. The article ends with, no state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any duty of tonnage, keep troops or ships of war in times of peace, enter into any agreement or compact with another state or with a foreign power, or engage in war unless actually invaded or in such imminent danger as will not admit of delay. Again, reiterating the fact that we are not allowed to keep our own armies, though we can have a National Guard, and we can't make alliances with other states or national government for help unless we're actually being invaded. So if Ireland decides to invade Boston, then maybe Boston and Massachusetts can enter into an alliance with Canada to stop them. Or if the U.S. government isn't responding fast enough, we can call on other federal governments to help us. But we can't just call up Ireland or Canada and ask them to enter into an allegiance with us any old time. There have to be rules. This is a question now, as many secessionist movements are taking place within the United States. Years ago, if you ask people, a majority of people would say they didn't believe in any type of secession, and they didn't believe secession would happen. And about a third of people said that they weren't really interested at all, they didn't know, they didn't care, and a very small group of people said yes. The Pew Research surveys came out two or three years ago, and what happened was fascinating because what you had is a third of people who say, yes, they can secede, yes, they probably will, yes, they probably should, a third of people who still said no, but that third in the middle became much more leaning towards secession, but also kind of not caring. And so we no longer have a majority, at least of the people taking these polls, who say no secession under no circumstances. So this is a question that's going to come up, particularly as the internet overlords drive up partisan polarization, regional hatred, racial hatred, and so on. These ideas of whether or not we can live together are going to break one way or another. They're either going to break by the country breaking apart, or they're going to break by people in positions of power finally holding the internet and the other bad politicians who are doing partisanship accountable. I honestly don't know which one is more likely at this point because it just all seems crazy. But there's always been a sort of Texas, Texit kind of secessionist movement. But now we've got CalExit with California. But you also have things like the Republic of New England, parts of Cascadia, Laurentia. This is parts of New York, parts of upstate New York, as well as parts of the industrial Midwest. These are small in magnitude, but they're magnitudes of bigger than ever before. And it does bring up questions of how much states can coordinate with each other, regardless of whether their intent is to secede or not. When the Department of Health and Human Services started deleting data, this is data that your tax dollars have already paid for, by the way. So it's literally your data, right? They were deleting data on flu shot effectiveness or maternal health. This has been detrimental to my own research in maternal health, but different regions picked up the slack by creating regional health organizations. And a lot of these are in their early stages now. It's unclear how much these groups can operate within constitutional bounds. As long as it's specific to something like transit or health, they should be just fine. But it's unclear where the lines get drawn. It also means that groups like CalExit aren't supposed to ask Mexico for help if they secede, or the Republic of New England shouldn't ask Canada to be on standby. But it makes it really unclear under what circumstances are states in such a bad way of public safety that they can call on other states or other governments for help. It looks like the founders knew some of us would eventually want out, but they didn't do a great job of spelling out when and whither any state could secede from the union with or without federal government approval. Not that it's a question that'll ever come up again, we hope. So that's it for Article 1. Can you believe it? It only took us 3 months. So if you're ever thinking reading the Constitution is hard, yeah, well, it is. But now you've got some of that skill under your belt, and you can go forth and conquer the world with it. Next week, we'll get into Article 2 and the presidency. In the meantime, share this podcast wildly so we can get some traction. Because once we're done with the Constitution, we're going to need some feedback on where to go next. Cases? Amendments? Greatest constitutional crises? Think about it and keep the civic flame burning bright. Until next time, take care out there. The Civic Flame is a Dr. Fun Sponge Media production with writer Amber Veo and sound producer Matthew Munyon. Thanks for listening.